is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The mistakes from 2011 must not be repeated. Libya must not be left alone again. So the whole process must be under close international supervision. That's a role for the United Nations, for the Arab League, for the African Union, and maybe also for the European Union. We'll see if they are up to fulfill the expectations.
That's Wolfgang Porstei, a former Austrian military attaché in Libya, on the challenges the country faces to stabilize. Details coming up also. France is calling for an immediate return to civilian rule following the military coup in Mali. And the U.S. is intensifying diplomatic efforts to de-escalate Libya's civil war. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Here's our top story. France is calling for an immediate return to civilian rule in Mali following a military coup in the West African nation this week. The former colonial power has worked to stabilize the country since leading a 2013 military operation to oust extremists in the north. For VOA, Nicolas Pinot reports from Paris.
With Mali the cornerstone of French-led efforts to roll back jihadists in the Sahel, President Emmanuel Macron Wednesday repeated his call for a quick transition back to civilian rule. For the French government, it is a moment of uncertainty on whether it would see a return on what it invested to stabilize its former colony under the now ousted president, Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta, seen as an ally of Paris. Will the junta, now in charge, change its relationship with the former colonial power? Opposition coalition leader Choguel Maiga thinks that it is unlikely.
Quels que soient les responsables politiques qui veulent diriger le Mali dans
Choguel Maiga explains that any politician in Mali who is willing to lead the country according to people's aspirations has no interest in clashing with France, the main military, strategic and economic partner. Real politics should prevail, he thinks. However, he wishes to change what he describes as some malpractice in the relationship, and this kind of transition, he says, is a good opportunity to clear some misunderstandings. Paris, which has more than 5,000 troops stationed across the Sahel region, including in Mali, joined the United States and others in condemning the coup with Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian, saying in a statement that France strongly reaffirms its full attachment to Malian sovereignty and democracy. In Mali's capital, Bamako, Army Colonel Assimi Goïta introduced himself on Wednesday as the new military leader of the country. Goïta told journalists the junta, which calls itself the National Committee for the Salvation of the People, was now in charge and said Mali is in a situation of social-political crisis with no more room for mistakes. The soldiers said they favor a civilian political transition and new elections. The coup took place after weeks of protest, led by a coalition of political parties and civil society leaders demanding President Ibrahim Boubacar Keïta's departure. The main opposition coalition, M5-RFP, cheered the move by the military officers and said it will work with them on developing a roadmap.
Nous considérons que l'intervention de l'armée vient parachever.
Leader Choguel Maiga told VOA that the military coup was the achievement of the people's victory in Mali after months of protest. He considers the putsch as a rescue, and what comes next will depend on how the junta will deal with political forces in Mali. For now, soldiers announced a civilian transition, but it is not clear yet what they meant. The 15-nation West African bloc, ECOWAS, which had tried in vain to mediate in the long-running political crisis, said it will suspend Mali from its internal decision-making bodies. Speaking to VOA from Dakar, Gilles Yabi, the founder of WATI, a civil society organization that describes itself as a citizen think tank in West Africa, said this coup is a warning to other leaders in the region.
You have the president of Cote d'Ivoire, Alassane Ouattara, the president of Guinea, Alpha Condé, facing political tensions in their country. What happened in Mali could happen also in other countries of the region where people are unsatisfied with the way the country is governed and people are unsatisfied about the conditions of coming elections.
Rallies are scheduled to take place on Friday in Bamako and nationwide to celebrate what opposition leaders are describing as the Malian people's victory. Nicolas Pinault for VOA News, Paris.
The military coup in Mali was greeted by street celebrations in the capital, Bamako, but there was regional and international condemnation. The arrest and swift resignation of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita followed months of protests against alleged government corruption, the broken economy, and extremist violence. It's far from clear whether the military's promise of a return to democratic rule and national stability will be realized. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with John Campbell, a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria, who now is the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington. In the first of a two-part series, Adam asked if Tuesday's coup is good news or bad news for Mali.
Put in that framework, good news, bad news, I would almost say it's no news. Mali has been chronically unstable since 2012. More recently, there were very flawed elections the past spring, the results of which were thrown out by the Constitutional Court. At one point, the government resigned, was then reconstituted. Government progress against the Islamists in the northern part of the country, making virtually no progress. Demonstrations in downtown Bamako, the capital, meant that the fact that the government was toppled by a military coup is really not a surprise. A way to think about the coup is that it essentially occurred within the political class. Mali has been run for a long time by a political class and the military, and the two interpenetrate. So it was not a coup against those that have been running the country, but rather more or less among those that have been running the country. That is to say, a change, but a change that won't mean very much in terms of addressing the fundamental problems that Mali faces.
Speaking of the Malians themselves, one noticed in the press reports and the videos that there was a lot of revelry and dancing in the streets going on. Was all that just expressing a sort of short-term thrill?
That's exactly what it was. You will have noticed that when governments are toppled, there are often cheering crowds in the streets. Think of Robert Mugabe's fall in Harare, for example. And yet, as we saw in Harare, virtually nothing changed. That's how I would describe the celebrations that we saw in Bamako.
Now, the regional powers, ECOWAS, the African Union, most of the West and the UN have all condemned the coup as anti-democratic. Why would they do that if the outgoing government wasn't there legitimately because they had rigged the election?
It's a good question, and I think the answer is this. It was a coup, and it was a coup against a legal government, and as such is unacceptable.
But the leaders of the coup have promised elections soon and a return to civilian rule.
I guess my position would be it doesn't matter because the Malian government and the Malian political class are largely detached from the Malian people, so that when we talk about legal governments, we are essentially imposing a Western concept on an African state where it doesn't fit very well.
In your view, what is the primary feature of conventional Malian governments that differs from what we think of as a proper Western democracy?
A political class that essentially promotes its own self-interests with little concern for the population that it ostensibly governs.
That was John Campbell, a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. The U.S. is intensifying diplomatic efforts to de-escalate Libya's civil war and find a negotiated political solution. But Aguila Saleh, Speaker for Parliament in the East, told the U.S. ambassador to Libya he would never negotiate with the UN-backed GNA. German Foreign Minister warned against what he called a deceptive calm, referring to the nearly 2 months stalemate in Sirte, hinting at a real threat of escalation there between Turkey-backed GNA forces and Russian-backed LNA forces. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke with Wolfgang Porstai, a former Austrian military attaché in Libya, about the challenges facing efforts to stabilize Libya.
The minister is perfectly right. The military situation is still extremely tense. During the last 2 weeks, there were at least two attempts by Operation Volcano to launch a surprise attack and take Al-Jufra oasis. This was stopped by the LNA Air Force in a bloody way. There is a huge distrust between both sides. But this is not only regarding the military intentions, but generally also regarding the society and regarding political intentions. One must remember, over most of its history, Libya was never ever a unified state. What is today's Libya was only unified under a common administration and named Libya by the Italian colonizers at the beginning of the 20th century. The independent Kingdom of Libya under King Idris was until the mid-60s a federalist state with Tripoli and Benghazi as twin capitals. Only when Gaddafi took over, Cyrenaica and Fezzan were severely disadvantaged compared with Tripolitania, and this left real serious grievances. And after the revolution, the East and the South feel again underprivileged, especially with regard to the distribution of the oil revenues. So as long as these deep rifts between those involved in the fighting are not really addressed, as long as there is no real solution, there will be no way towards stabilization.
Is there a room for a sequential confidence-building measures to reach a compromise among Libyan sides to share power and revenues, apart from efforts by both Turkey and Russia to gain zones of influence in Libya?
Yes, absolutely. There were already some small steps during the last weeks. There was some exchange of some prisoners of war. And on Tuesday, the resumption of the oil exports was announced by the Libyan National Army. It needs to be seen if this really works and if there is a way for the distribution of these revenues, which is perceived by both sides as fair. But before this, another progress could be achieved by fighting the COVID-19 virus together. This is a common enemy, which is addressed in the most efficient way if it's addressed in a coordinated way. But key to confidence building would be a stable ceasefire, which must be really observed by both sides. This would be an important step and a precondition for any political process that would be really realistic lead to some kind of stabilization. Such a demilitarized zone would be absolutely necessary to prevent the resumption of fighting, but it was not yet discussed to guarantee such a demilitarized zone.
The U.S. is intensifying its diplomatic efforts, calling for de-escalation and a negotiated political solution. However, Aqila Saleh, the Speaker of the Libyan Parliament in the East, told the U.S. ambassador to Libya he would never negotiate with the GNA. What would it take to stabilize Libya beyond the current proxy war?
As said, there is a deep rift between both sides, and the centerpiece of any strategy for the stabilization of Libya after a ceasefire would be a bottom-up approach based on the old, on the former Libyan constitution. A countrywide reconciliation process and a compromise about the way forward for united Libya is for the time being not realistic. Therefore, any successful strategy needs to focus on a lasting stabilization of Libya in its parts, which means in its three historic regions. And the foundation, as indicated, for this process should be only for an interim period, the amended old Libyan constitution from the year 1963, which was abandoned by Gaddafi in 69. Amendments must absolutely include a formula for the distribution of the oil revenues and a division of powers between the central government and the three regions, as already defined by the original 1951 constitution. Only after a certain amount of stability all over Libya is achieved, a real state building, so gluing the pieces together, and the elaboration of a new constitution and countrywide elections could take place. I think if there is a stable ceasefire and if there is an agreement on this old constitution, such a stabilization and a new constitution could be achieved within a 4 years period. Nevertheless, the fight against terrorism in Libya must be continued. The international community must seek for suitable partners on the ground in the three provinces and work together with them. And key is probably is that the mistakes from 2011 must not be repeated. Libya must not be left alone again. So the whole process must be under close international supervision. That's a role for the United Nations, for the Arab League, for the African Union, and maybe also for the European Union. We'll see if they are up to fulfill the expectations.
That was Wolfgang Porstai, a former Austrian military attaché in Libya, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. Uganda's four-time presidential contender, Dr. Kizza Besigye, says he is not running again next year. His announcement has drawn mixed reaction, especially among the public and members of his party. Some think his withdrawal is premature, while others think it's time for a new opposition face. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Besigye, a retired colonel and a former Bush War ally of President Yoweri Museveni, has been an opposition figure who has put up a stiff fight for the country's top position. Many members of his Forum for Democratic Change FDC opposition party hoped he would return to the ballot in 2021. He announced yesterday that he won't.
The junta, the gunmen, are organizing another election to legitimize themselves. That's what they are doing. I told you that in 2016, both my hands were busy. This one engaging the election gears, this one engaging the fighting gears. That is not very efficient. Election gears are our plan A. The fighting gears are plan B. It is my humble decision that I have discussed intensively with my colleagues that we get somebody to lead plan A and you leave plan B for me.
Apollo Kantinti feels that Besigye would have been the best flag bearer for the party as campaigning is being reduced to stop the spread of COVID-19.
Yes, I know we have got strong candidates, but it's kind of going to be even more difficult to sell a new candidate in other areas when it's scientific. Plus, we know that the state machinery always bullies us and doesn't give us the space.
Another party member, Doreen Nyanjura, says Besigye's decision is understandable, especially since he has not completely quit steering the party.
Our commander is still around. He's simply going to take on plan B as other commanders take on plan A. So really, this means FDC is simply going to get stronger because there's division of labor. Understand their emotions because personally got emotion as well. But I had to understand his mess. But our fighters only need to be encouraged. They need to give support to whoever is going to carry our flag. Because Seven is still here, and I think that is our major enemy.
Ibrahim Semujunganda is the FDC spokesperson. He says it's high time the party concentrated on finding a new flag bearer.
If someone is not equal to Besigye, it doesn't mean that person is worthless. That is the trouble. And that's why you see the country and NRM stuck with Seven. Because they are trying to find him Seven. You will not find him. So Besigye has served as a presidential candidate, other people. I don't think FDC is short of people, but the people who remain behind now have a duty and an opportunity to provide leadership when it is most needed in our country.
Besigye's decision was met with what appeared to be great relief by the ruling National Resistance Movement, NRM Party. Emmanuel Dombo is the NRM spokesperson.
A number of times he has gone to court, and the courts have made their declaration. At one time, he even formed the People's Government. Now, I don't know what would become the fate of the People's Government, whether it will expire at the end of the 5 years. But all these were forms of resistance that were being tried to see if it could shake the foundation of the NRM. But for us, we have remained steadfast.
The 64-year-old Besigye was Museveni's personal physician during the five-year Bush War that ushered him into power in 1986. Museveni, now 75, has ruled Uganda for 34 years. Robert Kyagulanyi Ssentamu, a.k.a. Bobi Wine, now is his major challenger. Just like Besigye, who has been in and out of prison on trumped-up charges, Bobi Wine has faced allegations of treason and other obstacles linked to Museveni. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
The water situation in Bulawayo has deteriorated, with Zimbabwe's second-largest city dropping its rationing schedule, creating critical shortages and complicating efforts to fight the spread of COVID-19. Adigando gives us more on the story.
The suspension of the 144-hour water rationing schedule for 2 weeks has faucets running dry in more than 30 suburbs covering the major parts of the city and some industrial areas. Residents are queuing up as late as 11 p.m. to get what they can. Over the weekend, the city council announced interruption of water supplies to areas fed by the Magwegwe and Criterion reservoirs. Observers say the result could be a health disaster given the COVID-19 sanitary requirements, which include regular hand washing. The council said reservoirs need time to recover following the theft of 2 kilometers of electricity supply cables, 3 emergency leak repairs, and power supply challenges for Boers. City spokesperson Nessie Sampofu says officials had to change tack.
To this end, the city's reservoirs have greatly been depleted, which has required that the city departs from the current 144 program and is able to supply water only when the reservoirs permit. We are also trying to ensure by continuously shutting the water to ensure that our reservoir levels can pick up.
Mpofu paints a bleak picture, saying areas in higher elevations are being particularly hit hard.
So for the high-lying areas, we are not able to get water to flow upwards. The high-lying areas are therefore assisted by bowsers that go and provide water to the residents. These bowsers, unfortunately, are also inadequate as we only have 6. What we also do for the high-lying areas, some of them have boreholes. So the city of Flower has been fixing boreholes that have broken down, and we are rehabilitating them. And in some instances, we are actually drilling new boreholes with assistance of partners. But we also know that because of the severity of the water challenge, the boreholes are always being used, and in some instances, the breakdowns are more frequent, which means the boreholes are needing to be fixed.
Mpofu says the city is trying all it can. Water kiosks are being stretched too. Matesu Dube says the situation is unbearable in his suburb of Njube, and that more dams are needed because the current ones date back more than 40 years ago when the city was much smaller.
I can't blame the city council because it's like being in a bus that is not moving. What I mean, the economy is down, so the city council can't be seen to be functioning well during these economic challenges, because the money that we use to pay the city council cannot fund projects. Everyone knows that.
The council says its water dams, also hit by droughts, are at 25% capacity. The national government has so far refused the city's request to declare a water shortage area in its bid to mobilize resources to fund projects. Meanwhile, the Environmental Management Agency has taken the council to court for failing to upgrade water treatment plants and sewer systems, resulting in raw sewage flowing into the sources of water. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo.
Kenya's foreign ministry has managed to secure the release of journalist Yasin Juma from an Ethiopian prison where he had been held without charge for over a month and fell ill with COVID-19. The Kenyan embassy in Ethiopia says it managed to assist the Kenyan journalist to a government-managed isolation facility. Yasin Juma, whose real name is Collins Juma Osemo, was arrested in early July, shortly after the killing of Hachalu Hundessa, a popular singer from Ethiopia's Oromo ethnic group, sparked days of violence that left more than 200 people dead. The Committee to Protect Journalists says Juma was detained for allegedly failing to identify himself as a journalist during a police raid at the home of activist Jawar Mohammed, who was also detained. More than 9,000 people have been rounded up in connection with the violence that followed Hachalu's death, including high-profile opposition politicians and journalists. Juma has said he was in Ethiopia working on a documentary and as a producer for Britain's Sky News. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbil Yabaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
Hey, Sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on